for this morning is the talk is going to be on right concentration. So this morning we'll be on right concentration, right samadhi, on the four jhanas, which I promised to talk about earlier on this week, and again talking about exactly what they are, how to get into them, so one can recognize them after they've arisen, and also to understand their place in the scheme of things. And I was just mentioning that if one ever looks at the Buddha's teachings, the suttas, you find that jhanas is mentioned very, very often as a common theme which occurs almost in every teaching of the Buddha. And it is part of the Eightfold Path, the Samma Samadhi, the right concentration, is always defined as cultivating four jhanas. And in this meditation retreat, if we're really talking about meditation and we want to cultivate meditation, there's no reason why that we shouldn't aim to cultivate these jhana states, because they give a depth to one's meditation which one can experience as something quite special. And one can also experience like the power of these states, as well as the bliss of these states. And it's that quality of bliss and that quality of power which you will later be able to use to really develop the powerful insights into the nature of your mind and the nature of all phenomena. And I'll just begin maybe by just talking about the Buddha's own story, which is related in the suttas, that he attained a jhana almost by chance as a young boy, sitting under a rose apple tree, just watching while his father was doing some ceremony. And it was a very pleasurable experience. But what the Buddha, or the Buddha-to-be, remembered was just the pleasure of that experience, a little bit about its power. But like many people, like many meditators, many practitioners, he formed the wrong view that anything so pleasurable can have nothing at all to do with this thing about ending suffering, enlightenment. That something so pleasurable must be a cause for more attachment in this world. And it was because of thoughts like that that for 6 years the Buddha just wandered around the forests of India doing all sorts of ascetic practices. In other words, like almost looking for suffering, as if through suffering you can find an end of suffering. And it was only after 6 years of futility that the Buddha decided, having had a meal, and this is the way it's actually said in the suttas, that maybe he recalled this pleasurable experience of first jhana as a young boy. Maybe, he said, this might be the path to enlightenment. And the insight, knowledge arose in him. This is the path to enlightenment, to Bodhi. And because of that insight, the Buddha, as everyone knows, sat under the Bodhi tree, developed the jhanas. And based on the power of that jhana, the clarity of that jhana, developed all of these wisdoms. First of all, recollecting past lives, recollecting the action of karma, the depth of karma, how it sends beings to various types of rebirth. And then lastly, on the Four Noble Truths. And it was only because of the power of that sort of mind that he could penetrate to such a degree of subtlety and uncover things which have been clouded completely from him. And since then he always would teach and encourage this practice of jhana as an essential ingredient of the Eightfold Path, an essential part of becoming enlightened. And if one wishes to use Buddhism not as only a half-hearted path but take it to its fullness and aim for enlightenment, then sooner or later you'll have to come across these jhanas and cultivate them, get to know them and use their power and do exactly the same as the Buddha did and become fully enlightened. Now, many of the other talks which monks give tell you about the problem of suffering in existence. They tell you about the difficulties of life and the problems of rebirth and more death. But we also, you know, I think it's a responsibility. If you tell you the problem, we have to tell you the solution as well. and tell the solution in all its detail, not holding anything back. And part of that solution, an essential part of that solution, is developing these things which we call jhanas. Now, what these jhanas actually are, I just talked about the four jhanas this morning, and I'm going to carry on from that, I might call it launching pad of that second stage of meditation, which I've been talking about a lot while I've been teaching meditation during this retreat. That second stage of meditation, in my scheme of things, is where you have full, continuous awareness of the breath. So the mind is not distracted at all. Every moment it has the breath in mind. And that state has been stabilized with continual attention until the breath is continually in mind, no distraction for many minutes on end. That's the second stage in this meditation. It coincides with the third stage in the Buddha's Anapanasati Sutta, Sabbakaya Patisamvedi, that the meditator experiences the whole body of breath. But the body here is just the word for the accumulation of all the parts of an in-breath, all the parts of an out-breath. And this sequential awareness of these physical feelings. The next stage, the third stage in my scheme, the fourth stage in the Buddha's Anapanasati Sutta, is where, having attained that second stage and not letting it go, not letting go of the awareness of the breath one moment, one calms that object down, calms the object of the breath down. There are several ways of doing that. Perhaps the most effective is just developing an attitude of letting go, because the object of the breath will calm down naturally if you leave it alone. However, sometimes that some meditators have difficulty letting go to that degree. And so another method which can be very effective is just suggesting calm, 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 or suggesting letting go. There's a great difference between the attitude of letting go and suggesting letting go. Because when you're suggesting letting go, you're still actually controlling things. You're getting involved in it. But at least you're getting involved by sending it in the right direction, sending it towards the place where the attitude of letting go is occurring, without the need to put it into words or to give it as orders or commands. You're programming the mind in the right direction. But I use both, either just letting go as an attitude of mind, or sometimes just suggesting, just calm, calm, calm. And to feel the object of your attention being here, the feeling of the breath, get more and more refined, more subtle. The difficulty here, or the problem here, will be you have to always maintain your attention clearly on the breath. In other words, not letting go of the second stage as you develop the third stage. Keep full awareness of the breath, but just make that breath softer and softer and softer. More and more subtle, more and more refined, but never letting go of it. And as the breath gets more and more refined, I see the only way of not letting go of it is by treating it very, very gently. You're going towards an effortless awareness on the breath, an effortless attention. Well, the breath is just there. There's a bit of a problem here with many meditators, is that they're not quite sure of the correct way of knowing the breath in this state. There's a type of knowing which is just knowing, being mindful of, without naming, without thinking, without analyzing. A subverbal type of knowing. And you have to be confident that you're actually watching the breath. Sometimes you may not have the width of mind to know exactly what type of breath you're watching. But you know you're watching the breath. The point is, it's a type of knowing which is getting much more refined. Our usual knowing is very wide and full of many details. Here the details are narrowing down until the point comes where sometimes we have so few details that we don't know if we truly know. It's a different type of knowing. A much more refined knowing. And so the wisdom has to be very strong here, and confidence has to be strong to understand that one's still knowing the breath. The breath hasn't disappeared at all. And you do not need to, as it were, widen the width of knowing for an effort of will, which will just disturb the mind. Just allow everything to calm down. The object will calm down, and so will the knowing start to calm down. Then it's at this stage where we start to get a samadhi nimitta arising. I call this part of the third stage. If you calm the physical feeling of breath down, so the mental feeling of breath starts to arise. The samadhi nimitta. Usually a light which appears in the mind, however, it can sometimes just appear to be a physical feeling. It can be a deep peacefulness. It can even be like a blackness. The actual description of it is very wide, simply because the description is that which everyone adds on to a core experience, which is a mental experience. When it first arrives, we just haven't got the words to describe it. And so what we add to it, it's usually how we understand it for ourselves. Darkness, peacefulness, profound stillness, emptiness, a beautiful light or whatever. Don't particularly worry about what type of nimitta it actually is. If you want to know the way to develop that nimitta into samadhi, into jhanas rather, the fourth stage of developing the full jhanas, is you have to pay attention to that aspect of this nimitta which is beautiful, which is attractive, which is joyful, the pleasant part of it. And again, it's at this stage where you have to be comfortable with pleasure and not be afraid of it, not fear that it's going to lead to some sort of attachment, because the pleasure of these stages can be very intense at times, literally overpowering your sense of self, overpowering your control, overpowering your sensitivity to your physical body. So you have to look for that pleasure and happiness which is in that nimitta. And this becomes like the fourth stage, because once the mind has noticed the pleasure and happiness in that nimitta, that's what acts, what I call like the magnet or the glue. It is that which will draw one's attention onto it. And it's not the will or the choice or the decision which takes the attention and puts it onto the samadhi nimitta. In fact, once the choice, the intention, the orders inside yourself arise, they'll actually push you away. You have to let the whole process work. Because the samadhi nimitta at this stage is very pleasurable, it literally pulls the mind into it. And many meditators, when they experience, maybe their first experience of a jhana, experiencing the mind falling in to a beautiful whole. And that's exactly what's happening. It's the joy, the bliss, the beauty of that nimitta which is before the mind actually pulls the mind into it. So you don't need to do the pushing. You don't need to do the work. At this stage, it becomes a natural process of the mind. Your job is just to get to that second stage, calm that breath down, allow the samadhi nimitta to arise. And then once the samadhi nimitta arises strongly, then the jhana happens in and of itself. Again, because the quality of knowing is very strong but very narrow in these states, while you're in these states, there's no way that you can truly assess where you are and what's happening to you. The ability to know through thinking, through analyzing, is taken away from you in these states. You have to usually wait until you emerge from these states, until your ordinary thinking returns again, so you can really truly look back upon and analyze what has happened. Any of these jhana states are powerful experiences, and it's a powerful experience, they leave a deep imprint on your mind. Unfortunately, there is not a word in our English language which corresponds to like a positive trauma. The word trauma is like a very strong negative, painful experience, which again leaves its imprint in you. This is like similar in its strength and result to a trauma, that you remember it very clearly because it's such a severe, has a severe impact on your memory. However, these are just purely pleasant experiences. So it's like pleasant traumas. And as such, that you recall them very easily. And so after you've emerged from a jhana, it's usually no problem at all just to look back with the question, what was that? And to be able to see very clearly the type of experience where you've, the object which you were aware of for all this time. And then you can analyze it. It's at this point you can find out exactly where you were and what was happening. But in the jhana, you can't do this. In the jhana, one can know it by what the Buddha called the jhana factors. And these are the major signposts which tell you what particular state you've been in. And it's good to know those signposts. But remember, these are just signposts to these states. These are the main features of these states. And in the first jhana, there are many subsidiary features. In fact, the first jhana is quite wide. But however, if it's a first jhana experience, it has to have the features, the five main features, the five main jhana factors. The second jhana is much narrower, much easier to find out whether this is where you've been. And the same with the third and the fourth jhana, they get narrower still. The width of experiences, or rather the width of descriptions of this experience which you may offer, narrows down as you attain more profound depth of letting go. But with the first jhana, the Buddha gave it five factors. The main factors are the two, which is piti sukha, which is bliss. Sometimes if you look in books about the meaning of these terms, they will try and split these two terms into separate factors, which they are separate things. But in the first couple of jhanas, piti and sukha are so closely intertwined that you will not be able to distinguish one from the other, and it's more helpful not to try, but just to look at these two factors as just bliss. And that's the most accurate description, which most people can recognize. This is bliss. But the Buddha called it vivekaja piti sukha. That particular type of bliss, which is born from detachment, born from aloofness, born from seclusion. This is the word for viveka, seclusion, aloofness, separateness. And it means separated from the world of the five senses. That's what you separated yourself from. And this is the bliss of that separation. That's the cause of that happiness and bliss. And that bliss has a particular type of taste, which other blisses do not share. It's the bliss of seclusion. That's why it is also sometimes called the bliss of renunciation. You've renounced those things, therefore you're secluded from them. It's the other two factors which confuse people again and again are these two terms, vitakka and vichara, which even Bhikkhu Bodhi in his Majjhima Nikaya translates as initial and sustained application of thought. Or is that what he says? Initial and applied thought or something. However, it should be known and recognized that thinking as you normally perceive it, it's not present in these jhanas at all. That which we call thought has completely subsided. What these two terms refer to is a last vestige of the movement of the mind, which, if it was continued, would give rise to thinking. It's almost what you might call subverbal thought. It's a movement of the mind towards the meditation object. That's called vitakka. However, it has to appear on a subverbal level, just a movement, just an intention, without the mind breaking into words and labels. Once the mind moves on to the object, remember the object here, the thing you're aware of is the pitti-sukha. That's why it's the main factor of this jhana. You're aware of bliss. That's the object of your meditation. Not the breath, not the body, not any words, but you're aware of bliss. And you will also be aware, one of the characteristics of the first jhana is, I mentioned this before, the mind will still be wobbling a little bit. The bliss, which is the object of your awareness, will appear, as it were, to fade or to recede. And as it fades, as it recedes, as it weakens, the mind will go towards it again, attracted, as it were, by its power, by its bliss. And as it goes towards it, that's called vitakka, the movement of the mind onto its object. When it reaches the object, it will hold on to it, which is called vichara, which will be an effort of mind, but a very subtle effort of mind. And this is an effort of mind, this is not an effort of will. It's not an effort of coming from you. It's the mind doing it by itself. All along, you're a passive observer to all of this. And as it holds on to it, eventually, as it were, it will lose its grip and recede away from the object of bliss again. In this way, the object of bliss will appear to be wobbly, not truly firm. As such, the mind will seem to have a little bit of width to it, not truly solid. However, that width is so small, you never move far away from that bliss, because as soon as you move a little away from it, it attracts and pulls the mind straight back again. Because it has only got a little bit of width, it is why it counts as being one-pointed, one-pointedness of mind. All of the energy, the focus of the mind, being in one point, both in space, in one point in time, being that this experience does not change over many, many, many minutes in a full first jhana. This experience is maintained. Just the mind is going towards this bliss, and this bliss lasting there for a long time. Now again, this is only how you will see it when you emerge from the jhana. You will not be able to analyze this experience into five factors during that time, because the mind will not have that width, that ability to think, the ability to analyze while you're in the state. While you're in the state, all you'll be aware of is just the bliss. You're literally blissed out, not really quite knowing why or what's happening, but having some sort of feeling or confidence that this is worthwhile, this is beautiful, this is profound, this is worth doing, so that you can stay in those states. It's usual that a person's first experience of jhana will always be the first jhana, and after a while, the strength of the samadhi, what you actually brought into that state with you, will begin to decline, and the mind will move away from the bliss, and the vitakka will not be strong enough to take it back into it again, and you'll emerge out from the jhana. The jhana will break up, and you'll be able to think and analyze again. Thoughts will come up into your mind. And that will probably be one of the first things which arises after the jhana breaks, as it were. Again, the mind will still have a lot of happiness and bliss to it, but not as one-pointed. And the body will usually not be recognized at the beginning, only later will the mind care to look and see what your body's been doing all this time. The mind will be very powerful at this stage. You've just emerged from a jhana. You'll still have a lot of happiness and bliss. And in the words of the Buddha, that the mind will be malleable, be workable. It'll be like a piece of clay which is not too wet and not too dry, which you can turn into any shape you want just with ease, because of the power which you've invested into the mind. And that becomes like the experience of the first jhana. Once you've experienced that once, then it's good to find out what caused that jhana to arise. What did you do? Or more appropriately, what did you let go of to give rise to that jhana? Because instead of saying what you did, what you let go of becomes a much more powerful indicator of the ways into these states. And you usually find out that you develop that second stage and you start to let go of this controller, let go of the wandering mind, let go of the fear of these states. But especially let go of the controller and just allowed the mind to show its face when you're not there giving all the orders. Once you start to get to know this and get to know the ways into these jhanas, then you should try and develop them, to repeat them again and again. Because not only are you developing insight, you're developing the skill in letting go of things which are the causes of deep attachment. As you develop these jhanas more and more, they're very enjoyable things to develop. And sometimes people feel that a holy life, a spiritual practice, should be harsh and severe. But if you want to make it harsh and severe, that's up to you. But if you want to go on a happy path, a path of bliss, which is also going to lead to enlightenment at the same time, this is it. Even though these are very strong pleasures, mental pleasures, the Buddha said they are not to be feared. He said this in many places in the suttas. And there was one place, I've already quoted this before in this weekend, in the Pasadika Sutta of the Digha Nikaya, where he was told, the monks, that if a person develops these jhanas, makes much of them, is almost like attached to them, attached to their development, then there's four consequences of that attachment to that development. The word I'm translating as attachment here is called anuyoga. Yoga, as you know, comes from the, or rather our word yoke, comes from this word yoga. It means tying onto. Anu means along with. Tied along with. It actually literally means practicing frequently, doing it again and again and again. What some people would interpret as being attached to. He said there's four results from practicing jhanas in this way. Not five results, not three results, four results. And those four results of practicing jhana again and again and again are stream entry, once return and non-return, and arahat. And the Buddha was unequivocal about this. It does not lead to more attachment to the world, it actually leads to the enlightenment experiences, to the separation from the world. The way to develop them more and more, more and more, is as one develops the first jhana more and more and more, one can aim towards the higher jhanas. The only way you can aim towards the higher jhanas is before you enter this whole area of the mind we call the jhana realm. Because once you're in any jhana, you're stuck there, and you cannot give any orders or any commands. You cannot drive your vehicle once you're in any of these absorptions. The aiming, the driving, the putting in the instructions has to be done beforehand. It's very difficult to find similes for this. A very weak simile, but one I've used before, is like someone like charging into a house with four rooms. And the fourth room is way down the back. and the third room just a little bit before it, the second room is before that, and the first room is the one which is just outside the door. But the floors are made out of this very, very slippery ice. So you can't make any momentum once you get in the first door. All your momentum has to be built up from outside, so you charge the first door. And if you're going very fast, you may be able to slip right through the first room into the second room. If you're going really fast, you may even get into the third room. If you're going very, very fast, as you charge the front door, you may slip all the way into the fourth room. But once you're in any of these rooms, you can't add to your momentum. So the only way you can gain these deeper jhanas is by, before you enter any of these states, is to making sure that your effort to let go, your resolve to abandon, that your desire to settle all disturbances is so strong that you settle the disturbance of this doing mind, and next you settle the vitakka vichara, this movement of the mind, and you settle many other things as well. The mind settles down one after the other as it goes into the deeper jhanas. The second jhana is the first true state of samadhi, because here you settle down that which was the disturbance of the first jhana, which was the wobbling of the mind. The vitakka vichara has been abandoned. So now the mind has the object of bliss firmly unified with it. And in this state is the state of being like the rock-like samadhi, where there's this one object in the mind of bliss, and there's no room in the mind at all, completely one-pointed, stuck, solid as a rock, and blissed out. So the object is not moving at all, not changing an iota. There, one moment after another moment after another moment, because of the solidity and stability of that state, the second jhana will last much, much longer than the first jhana. The deeper the jhanas, the longer they will last. And you're usually talking in terms of hours for the second jhana, simply because it's a very solid state. Maybe the first jhana can just be a matter of minutes, but a good second jhana should be quite long. And it's very solid. And once you're in, there's no way you can get out, until the energy of that jhana just uses itself up. That's the only way. Because you cannot form the resolution, now's the time to come out. If someone calls you, you just will not hear them. They tap you on the shoulder. You will not recognize that, because you're completely separated from the external world. You're literally right in the center of your mind, and you cannot be contacted. Again, that second jhana, once it starts to break up, will break up into what is tantamount to first jhana, and then will break out into the verbalization of thought. You come down again. For those who want to explore these states a lot, the one important thing one can do, rather than just leave this to the momentum of your energy to quieten down, your energy of samadhi, is to make resolutions before you enter these states. You just need to say to yourself, I will just enter the jhana for half an hour or for 1 hour. And because the mind is very refined in these states, it will have power. Your suggestion will be like programming a computer. Once the hour is up, the mind will distend out of the jhanas. I'm not quite sure exactly how it works, but it does work. In the same way that you can, very often you can go to sleep and say, I will wake up at 3 o'clock, and you do wake up at 3 o'clock, 5 minutes either side without the use of an alarm clock. The mind, if you program it with mindfulness, responds. And so that's a very useful way, and a very good instruction to use those resolutions, so that you do not spend overlong in those states when there's maybe some appointments or some things which you have to do. Make the resolution first of all. However, again, when you're in that state, you cannot make a resolution, you cannot think, you cannot analyze. All you know is you're blissed out, you're not quite sure what is happening, and again, only afterwards you have the opportunity to emerge and then to analyze and see what's gone on and why. If one wishes to go deeper into the jhanas, then one has to, at this point, understand that that bliss, which is in the second jhana, born of samadhi, born of full unification of mind, again, a bliss with a different taste, has an aspect to it which is still troublesome to the mind. And that is that this aspect of piti, almost like a mental excitement. And that can be overcome if one aims to quieten that bliss down, almost like to abandon that bliss of a second jhana. Again, that resolution or that intention has to be formulated outside of any jhana. And what will happen then is, having gone into a first jhana, gone a bit further into a second jhana, that happiness and bliss which is attracting the mind will dissolve and will remain another type of bliss, which is a bliss of pure sukha, far more refined, more delicious. And that is the object of the third jhana. Because it's more refined, because it's more delicious, the mind will be even more stable. And you wonder how that can be possible, that these actual states exist. Now you think that the first jhana is the most blissful thing that could ever occur in the universe, and then you find there's a deeper bliss. Then the second jhana you think, crikey, this must be the limit. And then you find there's a deeper, more profound happiness, which is pure sukha. This is pure happiness without the addition of pity. Trying to find similes to describe it is just almost impossible. I just haven't got the ability to describe similes for these states. There's an aspect of happiness that's been removed, and another more profound aspect of that remains, the sukha. And eventually one wants to abandon even that happiness as well, which remains. And one aims for that, again, outside of a jhana. And if one has enough resolution, enough ability, which one has built up, enough momentum, then one will go all the way into a fourth jhana, where the mind is not concerned with such core things as bliss, and is fully occupied with equanimity, an unmoving, equanimous state. These are the stages of jhana. And not only as you go into the deeper jhanas do you usually stay longer in these jhanas, because their stability is increases, but also the effect they have on your mind increases as you go to the deeper jhana. The deeper jhana you have, the more power, the more oomph your mind has afterwards. And in particular, as far as gaining insight experiences are concerned, when you come out of these experiences, again, the first thing which I encourage you to do is to look back and analyze what was this. Analyze it in terms of the Buddha's jhana factors. This is why I'm teaching this, so it gives you the framework for which to know what's happened. And then also analyze it deeper through your own experience, so you know fully what we mean by piti sukha or vitaka vichara, these terms. You've got the framework, you apply it to your experience, and you get to know exactly what was going on. Where were you in your meditation? I like to make meditation methodical, so you do know where you're going. You do know where you've reached, so you know how to develop this meditation further. Once you know where you've reached, then if one wishes to develop true insight, the liberating insight, the insights which will make you go in these stages of enlightenment, then it's a time to ask the question, why? What exactly happened to cause these states? In particular, why is that blissful? The bliss that you've experienced and what you experienced next, what you experienced before, what is the difference? When you investigate bliss, you're also investigating dukkha. You're investigating the first noble truth. The absence of dukkha is a bliss. The absence of one bliss, when you go to a higher bliss, is realizing that first bliss was also a form of dukkha. You're seeing an aspect of reality, of the depths of dukkha, which ordinary people are not privileged to see. You're understanding how even bliss comes under this word dukkha. Because when you let it go, there's even higher bliss. In particular, just even getting into a first jhana. The Buddha said that if you can get into a first jhana and look back upon it with insight, then that is sufficient to destroy the defilements, to destroy the asavas. Because what you're looking back on, you're looking back on the state where you've removed yourself from all sensory activity in the five senses. Sometimes that people have the idea that what enlightenment means is being equanimous to the objects of sensory activity. So if you see a sensory pleasurable feeling, it is equanimous to it. A sensory painful feeling is just equanimous to it. A sensory neutral feeling is just equanimous to it. We think that's letting go. What we're doing is letting go of the objects, the sensory experience. Not letting go of the subject of sensory experience, which is sensory experience itself. We're still experiencing. We're attached to experience. Or rather, we're attached to experiencing. When we're experiencing, we won't let go of sight, we won't let go of sound, we won't let go of the other senses. And so we will always get sometimes happy feeling, sometimes unhappy feeling. Whether you're attached to it or not, it's still painful. Whether you're attached to it or not, it's still happy, depending on which particular feeling it is. The problem has not been solved at the root. As I mentioned in the talk earlier on today, the problem of attachment is not what you're attaching to, it's what's doing the attaching. If the problem was what you're attaching to, you let go of this object and it should be finished with. You find yourself letting go of one object and you hold on to another object. And then you let go of that object and you're holding on to another object. And mindfulness will never be quick enough, will never be able to stop you letting go of any object. Once you've got a hand, then you will hold on to things. The problem is not sort of clenching the fingers. The problem is having a hand in the first place. Unless you realize through just reflection on something like a first jhana, there you've got no sensory activity of sight, sound, smell, taste, or touch. It's gone. There's the end of attachment. Not as a theory, but as an experience. The end of attachment being bliss, not as a theory, you're experiencing bliss. This is what it's like to having given up sight, sound, smell, taste, and touch. Basically, those five senses are what constitute your body. That's what a body is for. A body is just to house these five senses. And all the activity of this body is to keep these five senses going. That's why death becomes like an ending of the five senses. The five senses become inactive. That's what we call death. However, it's not the body as much as dying as the five senses are dying.
And that's why we try and preserve the body, just so we can preserve the five senses. You know, actually, the attachment is not so much to muscle and to bones. The attachment is more to experience, sensory experience. We want to experience our sense of being is tied with the sense of experience. A being is that which is sensitive to the world. Not a being is not something which has a body. A rock has a body. Brick has a body. But it's not sensitive. But these five senses is what we call the attachment to the body. These five senses which define our death of the physical body. And we have to get beyond that by learning just how these five senses can be let go of even while this body is still alive. The blood is still flowing through it, where it's still warm. You let go of these five senses and you realize this is bliss. Why am I always holding on to these five senses? Why do I cultivate them? Why am I so concerned with them? Because you don't realize that letting go of them is bliss. This is one of the great insights which can come as a result of a jhana. Seeing a Dhamma which is very hard to see. Only when you have that perspective can you fully see it. You fully see that these five senses are nothing to do with you. They're non-self. They're impermanent. They're not impermanent because one moment they arise and they pass away again, then they arise and then they pass away again, quickly, one thing arising and then the other passing away. That still gives the impression of continuity. This is arising and a passing away, and they stay passed away for an hour or two. That's really what we call impermanence. Really gone. Then they come up again afterwards. They're gone for a long time. And that really shows their insubstantiality. They can disappear. And they can, if they can disappear for an hour, they can disappear for an eternity. So this gives us a very deep understanding of impermanence. It gives us a great deeper understanding of dukkha. What is suffering in the world? Again, one of my favorite sayings of the Buddha is, only because we haven't thoroughly understood dukkha that we keep on getting reborn. Because we haven't fully understood the Four Noble Truths. Do you understand the Four Noble Truths? I think everyone can recite them, Four Noble Truths. But what is it we don't understand about it that makes us not enlightened beings? When the Buddha says things like that, I always sort of take what the Buddha said seriously and pondered it in depth. The Buddha said that it's through not seeing fully the Four Noble Truths that you monks over there aren't enlightened. And I said, I know the Four Noble Truths. It's the word fully was the word you should really dwell upon. Not fully understanding the Four Noble Truths. Not fully understanding dukkha. Because when you look at dukkha, the truth of suffering, there's an area which we call our blind spot, which we don't apply that adjective to. Part of our experience, which we take to be a self, which mindfulness has not seen, which mindfulness will not see, refuses to go even close to that area. And you cannot see a blind spot. That's why it's called a blind spot. There was, I gave a simile, and this is from a simile of Ajahnananda, who was a monk. Some of you may have met him before. He visited here a few times. He's dead now. And while he was a Marine, a US Marine in Vietnam, and got shot in the back of the head, which is how he got out of the army. And actually, it knocked a bit of sense into him, and he eventually became a monk instead of a tough Marine. And he was actually a very nice fellow. And you know, knowing him in his later years when he was a monk, it was just really hard to sort of equate that this really soft and kind monk could have been, you know, a US Marine. And like a delinquent in the United States. That's what delinquents used to do, to join the Marines to get tougher. You know, he volunteered to go to Vietnam. and to fight. And anyhow, that because of the injury in the back of his head, he had a blind spot to his vision. And it was only months after he was released from hospital that he realized he had a blind spot. I remember describing it to me. He was playing baseball. And somebody hit the ball high into the air, and he went to catch it. And he was following it with his eye, and then suddenly it just disappeared. The ball vanished. And then a few seconds later, it appeared again. And that's what a blind spot is like. The mind had actually filled up this black hole and made it sky or whatever. That's how blind spots work. You don't see them as blackness. If it's blind, you're blind to its very existence. And it's a very beautiful analogy for awijja, or ignorance, or illusion. Ignorance, while you're ignorant, there's no way in the world you can know you're ignorant. It's only afterwards that you know, I was ignorant, that there was illusion. All the time, you cannot know it. There's an area of our experience we call our blind spot. You don't know that area even exists at the moment. Mindfulness hasn't even gone close to it. That's the area where the defilements live. That's where one hasn't applied dukkha to. That's what one is attached to. That's what keeps one in samsara. That's what one takes to be oneself. The blind spot. Doing something like jhana meditation uncovers that blind spot. Hang on, you've got rid of the five senses. You've got a completely different experience, a perspective which is so powerful and uncovers. Hang on, I talk sensory experience. Experiencing. The experiencer. The one who knows. The one who receives all this information. I took that to be beyond dukkha. Beyond suffering. Therefore, I was attached to it. I was attached to experience itself, or the experiencer. I want to be, I want to feel, I want to see, I want to think, I want to cognize. These are the blind spots. And the only way you can get close to this is by doing something like these jhanas. Suddenly, the experience comes of the sensory experience disappearing. All you're left with is mental experience. Again, you cannot imagine what that sensation experience is like. It's a completely different experience to what you've ever known before. A jhana is like that. The deeper the jhanas, the more weird they become. They're weird in the sense that they're very different than ordinary experience. And they're blissful, but they're very different. And it's because of that difference you're starting to explore a part of the universe which you never knew before. And it's a part of the universe which will inform you, which will leave you with a wisdom which you never knew before. If you use those jhanas wisely and don't just bliss out on the pleasure of them, but also analyze them with insight, and these are the insights which you'll come up with. And it will blow away your blind spot. And quite naturally, whether you like it or not, you will become one of the enlightened ones. The Buddha often said that the cause of seeing things as they truly are, yathābhūta jñāna dasana, is samādhi. Deep samādhi sees things deeply the way they are. Whether you like it or not, the whole process starts to happen. Boom, boom, boom. Seeing things as they truly are. Dispassion. The sense of, why was I doing this in the first place? What a stupid person I've been for lifetimes. And you let go. Letting go is not done from yourself as an act of will because you think it's good for you. Letting go is done as a natural, unavoidable consequence of seeing the Dhamma. You don't do it, the Dhamma does it. Enlightenment happens not because you decide you want to become enlightened, or you don't want to become enlightened. You haven't got a choice in this matter. This is a natural process, a natural consequence, unavoidable. You haven't got a say in the matter. So this is one of the most powerful consequences of developing jhanas. It's why if you use the resulting mind having emerged from a jhana to contemplate in this way, you can contemplate without hindrances. The mind is strong and powerful because these five hindrances, those like sensory desire, ill will, restlessness and worry, sloth and torpor and doubt, have been eradicated, knocked out, and they stay unconscious, as it were, for many hours. Every time you go into a bliss state, if you come out afterwards, your mind is, as it were, cleaned, tuned up, empowered. Whatever you look at, if you go out and look at the flowers, just the flowers are amazing. Just one little flower, there's so much going on in there. In the old terms of the hippies, your mind gets blown apart just by one flower. Because the mind is that sensitive, that strong, that penetrating. And you'll know that after good meditation. You'll experience that. You go outside and sometimes just get stuck on a flower. Maybe for an hour, just watching it. Blissed out on its beauty. You can't do that with an ordinary mind. An ordinary mind is too restless. It sees, that's a nice flower, and then it goes on to something else. Never truly sees deeply into something. But that's just looking at a flower. You can get high on looking at a flower with such a mind, but you don't get enlightened. If you are one who is aiming at enlightenment, if you're interested in the truth, the Dhamma, the nature of reality, then that's where your mind will incline to. You'll look, you'll analyze, you'll penetrate, you'll discover. Because the mind has the power. This is the way not just monks and nuns, but lay people in the past have uncovered the Dhamma and become enlightened beings, stream enterers and once returners, non-returners. So this is why I like to teach jhanas, to see if we can get some more enlightened people in the world. So there you are. That's how it's done. Now, is there any question about what I just talked about today? Yeah. Yes. Okay, you want the distinction between access concentration and jhana. Actually, the Buddha never talked about access concentration at all. He just talked about jhana. However, even though the Buddha never used that term, you can spot a particular type or stage in one's meditation which you can call like neighborhood concentration. The neighborhood concentration will be when the samadhi nimitta appears, but it's not quite stable yet. So the mind cannot actually go on to it and remain on it. That will be in the terms of the stages I've taught here, the neighborhood concentration, which is just below the full concentration. What they call access concentration is usually called apana, which means actually you've accessed concentration. You've got in there, which is the concentration of the samadhi of full jhana. Again, I don't really like the word concentration, even though that's true. The reason I don't like it only emphasizes one aspect of the samadhi state, the fact of one-pointedness. So it's not just concentration, it's also bliss, it's also refinement, it's also abandonment, simplicity of mind, throwing away all diversity and just having one thing left. So because concentration gives the idea of force, and it does not carry with it the way in to these one-pointed states. You don't concentrate and screw your mind on these things. You just let go so much. Let go, let go, let go, let go. Abandon. Simplify. And that's the way into these jhanas. But the neighborhood concentration, the upachara, is just before when the hindrances are abandoned, so the mind is clear. You still have the samadhi nimittamati coming up. You still need to just point the mind onto that thing and allow the absence of the five hindrances to become so strong that the samadhi nimitta is very bright and just calls the mind into it, which is the accessed concentration, the full attainment of the state. Does that make sense to you? Yeah. It's an interesting point there, like time scales for these things. again, because you're going to very refined states of mind. I mentioned this before, and I'm not being flippant here. Sometimes it depends on your experiences in past lives. If the mind has had experience with jhanas before, then there's something inside of you just knows what to do. And because of that, if you can trust in that, then some meditators, they can just boom, 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 go very deeply, very quickly. Remember the Buddha, in one night, he only had first jhana ever before, and that was years ago when he was a kid. 1, 2, 3, 4. So it is possible, but then the Buddha was a special person who'd done jhanas before many times in previous lives. And sometimes you wonder, I mean, why are you meditating? Why are you coming to study Buddhism? And a lot of other people aren't. Where did that inclination come from? And it's very likely it's been developed over many lifetimes, rather than thinking it's just something which has suddenly arisen in this lifetime. And so you're meditating now, it's very likely you've meditated Dhyana meditation before. Certainly does not need to be dismissed. But sometimes it's uncovering something which you've done before. That's why a bit of encouragement and confidence, not to be scared of one's own abilities, is so useful. Yes?
I want you to call the state of complete contentment, peace, and this lack of anger, lack of desire, but very aware that not, I don't think it's done.
I call it temporary. No, so it's a complete lack of complete contentment, lack of desire. That state is very beautiful, very nice, and very useful. It's not the full jhana yet. It's a state of like equanimity. And by itself, there are other states which are more powerful than that. And you'll find is, as there are deeper levels of happiness, so there are deeper levels of contentment. Powerful levels of contentment. So it's our sensory apparatus can sometimes go to one level and think that's as high as it goes. And sometimes it's you need someone like a Buddha to come along and say, there's a bit left yet. Go deeper. Again, the paths into these states of jhanas is a very clear, clearly defined path. It has to be a gradual practice in that particular order which I've been talking about. You can go through that order very quickly if you're very skilled, but you have to go through that particular way of settling the mind down. And if one does experience these states, then one will know that they're powerful. And it's a skill of a meditation teacher to be able to listen to a person's experiences and to, in depth, again and again and again, and listen out for the telltale signs which will tell you whether it's a full jhana or not. Again, sometimes the first jhana is one of the hardest ones to pin down because there's many states which are very close or may even be first jhana. but the second jhana is much easier to pin down. Sometimes that you listen to a person and you say, well, that sounds like first jhana, but personally that I always can have doubts in my mind, is it or isn't it? Because I wasn't the one doing the experiencing. I'm only going on their description. The only way to do that is to keep on experiencing, re-experiencing again and again and again. Again, the jhana is a bliss state. So usually afterwards people come out with a big smile on their face. Eyes twinkling. And that's usually one way you can tell. And they give you energy. You know, you're not at all sleepy. You can't just go and do a jhana and come out afterwards and then go to bed. And go to sleep. These are powerful. They leave a residue, a very strong residue. There are certain signs and telltale signs which I listen for when, I'm not going to tell you them because I give the game away. I listen to when people tell me their experiences, and then you can get a good idea what they're doing. Be careful though, because sometimes when you start talking about jhanas, they're very important to talk about, but sometimes that you get into pride and ego comes in and say, I wonder if anyone else has got jhana yet. You hear that someone else has got jhana. Why can't I? And sometimes what happens, and this is a great danger in talking about jhanas, is people want to achieve so much that they actually imagine these states. They concoct them. And it's a strange thing, but sometimes people can fool even the greatest meditation teachers by concocting descriptions which aren't jhanas at all, but which they make appear to be jhanas. That's why sometimes the meditation teacher will be very skillful in finding out what's going on. Now don't concoct, wait for these things to occur naturally. It doesn't really matter when you achieve them, if you achieve them, as long as you're quietening the mind down, taking it to more and more deep states, as long as there's progress being made, that's good enough. Exactly what type of progress doesn't matter. You've been in samsara many lifetimes. One or two more lifetimes is not going to make all that much difference. Yeah. Is the state of jhana some sort of hypnotic state? I don't know. I've never been hypnotized. But it's very difficult to say, except from guesswork. But the inner state of jhana is coming from you. It's not coming from someone else. Hypnosis is putting yourself under the command of someone else. Also, in hypnosis, that you are aware of words from outside. In jhana, you are not. You can be controlled in hypnosis. In jhana, you're beyond control. So those are some important differences. I'm not quite sure. I think from what I've heard and read, a person who is hypnotized has got no awareness at all of what they're doing or what's happening. I'm not sure if that's true or not, but I think that's what I remember. Whereas in a jhana, you are perfectly aware of what's going on. You haven't got the wit to figure it out at the time. Oh, to setting time limits for things is quite common. You don't have to be in a jhana to set time limits for things. You can do that very easily. You can try it out this evening. When you go to bed, don't set your alarm. And say you're going to be up at 10 to 4 or quarter to 4. Just say that very clearly to yourself. The mindfulness is an important quality there. You mindfully make the resolution, full attention, I'm going to wake up at 3:45 tomorrow morning. And you can set your alarm clock to 3:50 just in case it doesn't work. But it's amazing how often it works. But that's in an ordinary state of mind. Here we're just the state of jhana is something different. Any other questions? Yeah. We're asking about the other levels of jhanas which are available, because there's also, as well as the four jhanas I mentioned, the arupa jhanas, and it's also the last, which is not really a jhana, the ninth level as it were, which is a very important thing to understand, which is the complete cessation of perception and feeling. And even though the Buddha sometimes called the other jhanas Nibbana here and now, it was only as an approximation, whereas the so-called ninth jhana, or the cessation, the Buddha made perfectly clear, this is the experience of full Nibbana here and now, full cessation. And anyone who experiences that state, sometimes that people say, well, you can't really gain insight through jhana. There's an automatic insight that has to occur with everybody, without fail, if you gain this so-called ninth stage of cessation. When you emerge afterwards, you're either an anagami, non-returner, or a full arahat. There's only two possibilities when you've tasted cessation. However, to get that stage, you've got to get at least first jhana, first of all, and then work your way up. So don't run ahead of yourself on that one.
And John,
is there any other traditions that use jhanas? Yeah, has there any other traditions ever used jhanas? Yes. It's very common in spiritual life. It's almost certain that the Christians use the jhanas. Teresa of Avila. At the last ranger retreat I read, someone gave a book of hers about the mansions. What's it called? The Eight Mansions or something? Or Many Room Mansions or something. And she's not clear at all about her meditation. The way she writes is not sort of methodology. It's not very clear. Forget a word now.
So it's very difficult to be sure, but she does give some of the telltale signs that she had attained some jhanas in her practice. However, it's interesting that what she interpreted those experiences to be were such things as, instead of like unification of mind, as unification with God, like complete marriage with God. And it's interesting that the experience at the time she would, again, not be able to make head nor tail of, but when she came out afterwards, she would look back at that was really marvellous, powerful. What was that? And you can see how perception, based on views, would come up and say, that was the most powerful, awesome, beautiful experience I've ever felt in my whole life. And of course, what would a Christian call that? But God. That must be what God is. And if that is one's cultural background, that's quite obvious how that would happen. If one is a Hindu, for example, a few weekends ago, I saw a video of Ramana Maharshi, the guru in South India who died in about 1950. And again, a very impressive lifestyle this person lived, and did a heck of a lot of meditation, and lived such a life of renunciant. All he ever wore was just one loincloth and had hardly any possessions at all. Certainly less possessions than your average monk at Bodhinyana Monastery. And as he did a lot of meditation, but he would also, because of his background, would interpret those states as unification with the divine. And again, it really depends on how he used that language, whether he believed in it implicitly, whether it would be full enlightenment or not. Again, you've got to be careful here, because you're in very subtle areas. But anyhow, that the jhana tradition was and is used in many different religions and paths. Full mystic experiences, leaving aside experience of the world. And it's why that all of those mystic traditions in all those religions would always be, as it were, almost like world denying. You know, they would leave the town and their houses and they go to ashrams, or they go to monasteries, or they go to mountains or jungle. And again, it's not because one would be averse to the world. One is not being pushed away from negativity, but one is being drawn by the attraction
of renunciation, the bliss of renunciation, the happiness of the jhana state. So you're not saying I hate the world, you're saying I love jhanas. And that's why you have the renunciant tradition in all the religious paths which develop that. So yeah, it has been in many traditions. But again, jhana by itself, unless it's got some background of decent teaching, it's very easy to mistake the power and the bliss of the object of a jhana to be some divine being or some essential self. And that's where the Buddha was so effective. He was saying, even that too arises and passes away. It's not a self. Even the bliss of a jhana is something which is beyond that. Do you want to say anything more now?
I guess that then they'll give us some kind of basis for an economical kind of a situation, so the monastic Christians have been anyway.
Does it give you like ecumenical? It is, in the sense of practice, yes. But the way you interpret those experiences makes a lot of difference. Because if you interpret that as being a god or a self, then it's still very much that's where an attachment to that state can really arise. And then one truly is still attached to the world. But the Buddha was far more radical in saying that even gods have to be destroyed. But there is a similarity there, and there's a similarity in the results of anyone who practices a lot of jhana, just that otherworldliness, not particularly concerned about the world outside unless they really have to be, and they're looking for the pleasure inside the mind.
I guess there are some Christians who do say
that. Oh yeah, sure. Yes, but I mean, again, a lot of Christianity now has become very much service in the world. And the mystic tradition is becoming not the main focus of Christianity. You know, the priest, the nun, is supposed to go out and start a school or a hospital or a hospice or something. So the mystic tradition in Christianity, the monasteries are becoming empty. So I've been told.
In a slightly different sense, people talk about a marriage with the divine, but they mean the divine within themselves, and they see, you might say, God being imminent and transcendent at the same time. So how would the Buddha see the concept of the divine aspect of the self?
How the Buddhists look upon a divine aspect of the self? This is one of those blind spots I was talking about earlier, places which one refuses to put such terms as anicca, dukkha, anatta, impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and non-self. Because in the context of what I've been saying earlier, if a person experiences one of these states, it will always be one of the most awesome experiences of one's life. And the deeper one gets, the incredibly powerful. And the point is, how do we interpret this? That's the experience, but what does perception do with it? Well, how do we think about it afterwards? And it's because of what I was saying earlier about this cycle of views being the main reason why we perceive it in one way rather than another way, we would actually take on this as being like a divine, because this is our background, and it's a Christian background, we actually have this concept of the divine and this sense of importance of the divine. However, the Buddha would say, analyze that, be careful. And he would say, no, there's no such thing as a divine principle which is permanent, imminent, and everywhere. All such principles arise and pass away like everything else in this universe. All empty of an abiding essence. Which goes against what we want to believe. Because it's nice to believe that, well, maybe I don't exist, but there's some sort of divine sort of essence which I can latch onto and thereby sort of escape complete destruction and annihilation. And sometimes that's what we do. We look for some nook or cranny in sort of this phenomenological world in which to hang the hat of me. Okay, I admit I'm not the body. Okay, I admit I'm not thinking. Okay, but leave me something. Leave me a little bit. And it's that sort of craving to be. It's called bhava dhanha, which makes one just jump onto these things as being a divine essence. Or if you're not sort of theologically minded, you might call it like cosmic consciousness or universal consciousness. This is it. At last I know universal consciousness. But you just go to one jhana beyond. You go, uh-oh, it wasn't universal consciousness after all. There's a simile which is in this is in the Gnostic Gospels. I mentioned this before, of God sitting in his heaven, and like God has got one of the biggest egos in the whole cosmos, because he says, "I am God, the firstborn, the greatest, the omnipotent, the maker, the father of all." You can't get a bigger ego than this. The maker of all that ever was and ever will be. And he goes on like this. Until then he hears a voice and says, "No, you're not. Who said that? Where did that come from? I didn't see who said that." And this voice says, "There are other beings in this universe, God, who are far beyond you, which you just do not know yet. Don't get beyond yourself." It puts God in his place. There's some of these jhanas as well. You get to one of them, there are other jhanas which are far beyond this.